Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. This is the show in which we talk about the movies or films that you forgot or we forgot that we'd even seen in the first place or you'd seen in the first place. Joining me as ever to discuss aforementioned flicks is the old leaky bucket boy, Mr. Joseph Devine.
Hello there. How are you?
Oh, I am full of beans, mate.
Really? You've been eating beans?
No, metaphorical beans.
Oh, metaphor beans.
My cuppeth of beans spilleth over.
Why does that come from beans? Do beans give you energy or something? Is that a saying that comes from a time before Red Bull or something? Is it the medieval version of Red Bull gives you wings?
Yeah, you know, beans, I don't know what they are. Like, is it protein or whatever? They're just they're a pulse, and they give you a boost. But yeah, maybe it's an advertising slogan.
Maybe. They give you flatulence. Maybe that's the kind of thing where the flatulence drives you onwards in a kind of physical combustion way.
But they also give you energy.
Yeah. Well, all food gives you energy.
I don't work for the bean board, but I'm just saying...
You don't work for Big Bean?
No, but...
Big Billy Bean?
Beans on toast, you're good to go.
Beans on potato. What's your favourite thing to have beans on or with? Actually, those are two very different questions. What's your favourite thing to have beans on?
Toast.
What's your favourite thing to have beans with?
Toast.
No, come on.
With?
Who would have beans on the side of toast? Unless it's part of a larger English breakfast.
I'll scoop the beans onto the toast.
No, the answer is beans on toast.
Yeah. With, I guess, I can't say potato, jacket potato, because
chips.
The beans... I don't want beans with chips. No, that's what ketchup's for.
Beans basically is ketchup.
No, it's not. Come on, beanie juice is no, you're not dipping, you're not choosing to dip a chip in.
Oh, man.
I mean, you can.
I do.
Oh, great.
That's a great pastime for me is beans and chips.
I am full of metaphorical beans.
Oh, yes, of course.
Because I shouldn't be too excited or happy, but I'm all by myself and my family are far, far, far away.
Where the hills don't lie on the mountainside. What are the lyrics there? Where the hills have eyes.
What's the song you sing?
Love lift us up where we belong. You know?
Okay, yeah.
I don't know why I'm singing that. I thought I was thinking, I'm all alone on the mountainside.
I thought you were being satirical. I thought, oh, he's being satirical. He's singing a romantic love song and he's trying to jibe me because I seemingly don't care about love and I'm happy if I'm completely by myself.
Yeah, yeah. No, I got confused with two different songs. I think I have some reason in my brain I've equated being all alone, being lonesome with love lived us up where we belong.
Yeah, you could have gone for Are You Lonesome Tonight?
I think that's what I was trying to go for, yeah.
But you've keyed into the wrong song.
So
I can be as loud as I like.
Do the hills all have eyes? Yeah, go on.
We're recording at 6:40. Oh. Usually we're recording at 9:30 and I'm trying to keep my voice down in case my booming larynx... You know, wakes a child.
Well, my wife's away as well, so it really is just a sad lad's time.
Sad lads. What do you do when your wife's away? Just sit at home alone and I record a podcast with my friend. You could see each other. No, we like to sit alone and we like to talk about films that we forgot we'd even seen in the first place.
Yeah.
That's what makes us happy.
Do you know what makes that worse as well is I was in my office yesterday and my boss's boss was there and her children were there. They'd just come back from a holiday and they were swinging by lovely children. And one of them was wearing a neat little hat that said, not everyone needs to have a podcast. And I laughed at it. I thought, oh, you know, ha ha. And then I walked through the door
cried.
And I felt cut to the core. I thought The child nailed me to the wall. The child knows. How does the child know? And yet here I am, you know?
I think it's come right back round now. I think it's deeply shameful to have a podcast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there
even
is
a successful one, even the one that people like.
There is no way that I could be. It's why I could say to someone, "Oh, I have a podcast." Because if it was a thing that people tried to do to be popular, I'd know that, and I'd be in my head. I'd say, "I'd have to keep it secret, and I wouldn't be able to be that guy."
Oh, so you use it as you use it as armor. Like you're saying,
yeah,
I've got one, therefore I'm okay saying it because obviously that doesn't mean that I think I'm good.
I must,
because otherwise I wouldn't tell you.
Yeah, I must be trash.
Yeah,
and they know I am. And right, then I'm giving them affirmation of that. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm doing improv and I've got a podcast.
Right,
I must be the lowest of the low.
And it's at that point where the strangers you're trying to talk to in the pub go, "Oh, cool," and then they walk back inside. That's it, right?
Yeah. And then the beauty of that conversation that we just had, it doesn't even happen because I'm in the pub and I'm reading a book.
Yeah.
And no one's ever coming over to me.
No. You're not approachable, I would say. When you're reading a book in the pub.
I mean, is that me personally or just generally? Are you talking
you personally,
like one?
You've got a laser-focused sort of physique. You look like the kind of man that does not want to be disturbed, you know? I think it's a good thing.
I was in the pub a couple of months ago and I was reading Lonesome Dove, a really fat Pulitzer Prize-winning Western, one of the great books, superb.
Who's it written by?
Larry McMurtry, who, incidentally, he wrote the screenplay for Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, that's cool.
Fantastic, phenomenal. You know, everyone should read it. You should definitely read it. Yep. Anyway, as I my appointment was arriving, I finished up my drink. I walked through the pub garden, and this voice said, "Hey, how are you enjoying Lonesome Dove?" An American voice.
Right.
And I said, "Yeah, it's amazing. It's the best thing I've ever read. I never want it to end." And she said, "Oh, yeah. Oh, boy." I said, "Okay, bye." And that was it. But that's all that.
Yeah.
You know, that was the conversation. And that was nice.
That's really nice, though.
Yeah.
And also, I would say to Americans, or perhaps people who aren't British.
Sorry,
maybe
for
you
the
aren't
accent.
Unapproachable. You know, no, not sorry for the accent. I thought it was wonderful. That they perhaps they're not picking up on those micro body language bits. The very nice American person, by the sounds of it, just was taking any opportunity to connect, and therein lies the upside and the downside of culture. You know, culture clashes.
Yeah, I think it's. If I saw someone reading, say, James Ellroy. In my head, I'd think, "Oh, I should go over and say, 'Oh, are you enjoying that? I love that one.'" But then I'd think, "Oh, they'll think I want something from them, and I don't want anything from them."
Well, there are obviously upsides and downsides, but like I always think about Laura Marling, the terrific
sado 2012. You hop in your time machine and go back to 2010
on.
And go,
no man. You take that back. I know your favorite band is Block Party, but take that back, because Laura Marling has, over the last decade, has written some of the finest music being written.
I'm not saying
recorded,
she's bad, I'm just saying she's irrelevant.
She's not relevant at all. She's more famous now than she ever was before. Very
That's
much so.
Like
she's
saying
just not
she's
in
the tallest
she's,
dwarf.
She's outside of your you know, little Overton window. You know, you've missed her now. You're not seeing her anymore because you've decided to pack up and have kids and, you know, only listen to very specific indie music from 2006. But Laura Marling's out there. She's doing great stuff. Anyway, you know, I didn't bring her up so that I could just defend her.
As if you thought for a second you could slip Laura Marling past me. As if, come on.
Anyway,
yeah.
Laura Marling, she's a terrific. One of the, I say sincerely, one of the best, the greatest living songwriters. She's a British singer.
Why are you telling the audience? They know. She's in the Everton window, mate. Well, I don't know why you're telling everyone who she is.
Because many of our listeners, as we know from emails, are just like you. They're people who are listening to this podcast with their children. They've checked out. You know, once every 6 months, they go to watch the Vines in concert or something. Remember the old days, right?
What a reference. Amazing.
Remember what it used to be like when it was cool back in the day. Yeah,
tell us how. explain who the Beatles are after you've done. Right, sorry.
Anyway, she's one of the greatest living songwriters. Because people may be familiar with her and her work, but they might not know that. I think that.
I was happy for that, and then you started explaining what she was, and I thought, here we go. I've got a tap in here. I'm taking this tap in.
In the early days of Laura Marling, when she was younger and first became popular, she was part of a kind of scene of you know, modern neo-folk music that came out of London and the southeast of England. And it was, you know, like that bands like Noah and the Whale. Remember them? I didn't really like them. Mumford and Sons were sort of like on the edge of this, this strange revival thing. But anyway, Laura Marling, you know, she had like a lovely voice, sang in an English accent. And then she went away for a couple of years, came back, recorded another couple of albums, and suddenly she had quite an American, I mean, quite a distinctive, like, American twang accent. And it became a bit of a talking point for people who listened to Laura Marling, because it felt like there was a notable lean into it. And, you know, it's always interesting to have that conversation about what accent people sing in versus what accent they speak in. It's pretty common, I would say, or at least it was before Alex Turner and the Arctic Monkeys. It was pretty common for, you know, guitar bands in England to have singers that sounded like they were American, and particularly in pop as well. And so when she started doing this, people started talking about it. Someone asked her about it, and she said this thing, which I don't know that I necessarily agree with completely, but I think it's interesting, about her different experiences of British people, you know, having grown up and lived in London, and American people having been exposed to them since she became famous, I guess, and was touring in America. And she said at that time, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, something along the lines of, she really admires and likes the sincerity of American people, American artists, and that they're not afraid to try to be vulnerable and say things, as opposed to English people who wrap up everything and shroud everything in sarcasm and cynicism and, you know, you'll never get me, you can never know me, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And before that, I always sort of thought of Americans as like cloying and, you know, like, oh, why have you always got to be so fucking sincere all the time? Why aren't you funnier? And then when she said that, I sort of thought, yeah, fair enough. I suppose when it comes to something as emotionally vulnerable as Laura Marling's music, it probably would help to be around people who weren't afraid to have a shot, try something.
Yeah, it's nice to be nice.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host, and Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
On today's episode, we are doing American Reunion. The fourth in the series of the American Pie series. It came out in 2012. Directed by John Hurwitz and Hayden Schlossberg. It's 113 mins, and it stars, of course, our favourites from the American Pie series. Jason Biggs as Jim,
yeah.
Alison Hannigan as Michelle, Sean William Scott as Stifler,
yeah.
Chris Klein as Oz, Thomas Ian Nicholas, Kevin Myers, he's not in anything else, Tara Reid pops up as Vicky, Mina Suvari of what's that one? American Beauty.
Yep.
Fame. She's Heather, and then Finch, of course, is Eddie K. Thomas.
Sure.
They're the gang. Who are your favourite out of those?
Jason Biggs is my favourite one. He's funny. I have to say, in films like this, Sean William Scott's character of Stifler is deeply unlikable, but at times Sean William Scott is probably the funniest of the funniest in terms of the acting performance of the actors involved.
Yeah, Stifler is appalling, but Sean William Scott is great. Oh, and the key support, Stifler's mum is played by the fantastic Jennifer Coolidge, and Jim's dad is Eugene Levy. They, of course, are best seen in the likes of Best in Show, mm-hmm. and those kind of Christopher Guest films.
Yeah.
They are very much slumming it in shit like this. It is 113 mins, and here is the letterboxed.
Oh.
Save the best piece for last. Oh, mate, the irony of that. The best piece. The best piece. This is the best piece.
Well...
The characters we met a little more than a decade ago return to East Great Falls for their high school reunion. In one long overdue weekend, they will discover what has changed. Who hasn't? And that time and distance can't break the bonds of friendship. I mean, that, you see, that is, could be such a rich film.
Sure.
You know, people going back into, you're old, aging, you've changed, going back.
Sounds like Garden State or something.
Sounds like Gross Point Blank.
Yeah, sounds like Gross Point Blank.
Sounds like a million other better movies.
Yeah. Sounds like that film Tag.
Oh, yeah, I actually quite like that. I'd love to have done that instead of this.
Sure, yeah.
This is very much your pick.
Yes.
You've really done me up, and I'm very annoyed that I let you get me on this. I've wished I'd let you get me on Three Billboards.
Is that was that the other one in contention?
That was the other one in contention, and I started watching this, and the opening sequence is the pits. It continues to get worse. You know these films really well. You've been trying to get us to talk about Pi. What were you thinking?
Well, American Pie. for a generation of people, actually. Probably, and I don't want to exclude anyone, but maybe I'll slim that down a little bit. For a generation of boys, American Pie, the American Pie franchise, I think it has played an important role or a notable, prominent role in people's lives. Everyone's seen it, yeah. Who's about my age? Everyone knows it. Everyone grew up with it. And hey, it's horrifying to look back and think this now, but it also introduced people of my age to some sexual concepts and sexual environments, which I think are you know, not a lifelike reflection, clearly. But I'm sure we can talk about that a bit more. But the other thing I think was there was a cultural moment of the time, and the soundtrack to particularly the first film is a really great, like, snapshot of that moment in time. Lots of songs that I really liked listening to, and you know that it felt like that first movie successfully, I would say, created a feeling for someone of my age at the time, which made me feel like something's happening here. This is something I can be a part of, and you know, I thought it was funny.
Okay, right. Unfortunately, Joe, we're not doing American Pie. We're doing American Reunion.
Yeah, but I never could have got you on American Pie because you haven't forgotten American Pie, you have forgotten American Reunion.
You could have got me on American Wedding.
Wedding.
You could have got me on American Pie 2.
American Pie 2 would have been much better than this as well. Yeah, this basically isn't a good film. But, you know, I think there are good things about some of those first three. They're obviously, you know, I don't want to have to caveat every time I say it, so I'm just doing it twice at the head of the episode. There are obviously very problematic things in the films, and I think it's very lucky that they made American Pie the Reunion in 2012, because if they tried to make it after 2016, they wouldn't be able to make it, I think.
Okay, well, let's focus in on this one. So
I've got to tell you something before we go any further, because I'm worried there won't be an opportunity for this. And it's important context setting for my viewing of American Pie Reunion today. I hadn't watched it because I couldn't, you know, as much as I wanted to do it for an episode, I didn't really want to watch that film. I wanted to be, you know, 13, and that wasn't achievable. So I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. And then last night I realized when I ended up staying out a lot later than I'd intended, I'm going to have to watch this film tomorrow before we record the episode. And unfortunately... I live in a building where there's a caretaker that lives in this building that looks after the gardens and the flats and whatever. And at the moment, he's like fixing something on our balcony. He's been out there for most of the days this week, and he's painting and sanding. And I sort of realized too late that I was going to have to watch American Pie: The Reunion during the day well, this man was just out on the other side of a window painting a balcony. And as a result of that, I basically skipped through every scene that had any nudity in it or anything that was inappropriate in any way, because I couldn't deal with the embarrassment of the situation. So that also might be some energy that I'm bringing to this recording as well, because I couldn't think of a way to explain to this man why I was watching this film during a weekday.
But, you know, it's a cultural totem. Everyone thinks they're fine, don't they?
Sure.
They are the equivalent. Like, recently, mm-hmm. in The Guardian, they've been... I think a book's come out about the sex comedies of the UK from the 60s and 70s. There was a whole series called the Confessions of a Window Cleaner.
Yeah,
this was a way for distributors and filmmakers to get a bit of smut into cinemas in those uptight times. But this, you know, we did these kind of sex comedies in the 70s. America, I mean, actually, yeah, America then did them. They did Porky's in the 80s. They were always a decade behind us, the Americans. And so the sex comedy, it goes back, way back. And I remember when the first American Pie came out, we'd had a very dry 90s, and everything had been very stiff. And stiff upper lipped, political correctness had gone mad.
Yeah.
And everyone was a bit sick of this political correctness thing.
Sure.
And I mean, I'm not being facetious.
No, I really recall.
When American Pie came out in the cinema, people lost their minds because no one had seen the amount of sauce and rudeness and boobs in a mainstream film. It hadn't been in the cinema. Like for a long time,
and I mean, there's rather a lot of sauce in that first movie.
Oh, indeed, it was a fantastic sauce for a teenage boy, and I know why you look back on that series. Oh, that's certainly the first one so fondly.
Yeah,
that was, when did that one come out then? That's 2002,
was it? Oh, was it 2002?
Well, the letterbox says
1999. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And this is 2006.
No, this is 2012.
2012.
Yeah, so this is 13 years later.
1999, that's one of the years, man. That's a good year. That film was seriously boffo.
Yeah.
The boffo box office of all time. It opened the gateway to all kinds of smutty, saucy sex comedies that weren't as good.
It took $18 million on its opening weekend, that film, which is more than the budget of the movie.
So just like I like to say Shrek wasn't important in culture... and it obviously was. I think we could say American Pie certainly made a splash, a cummy splash.
But this is the problem. Like, in all of your description, you started by saying we'd had a dry old 90s and it was all very stiff, and American Pie came on the scene and made a splash. It's like you're writing this in a nudie magazine or something.
Yeah. So that's, I'm just kind of getting myself up into a lather.
Yeah.
So what was nice about... Let's talk... I think we should go back to the original, because what is nice about the original, as much of it is outdated, it's also quite tame, even though women are getting their boobs out and things. The story is about four boys who want to lose their virginity. So it's this very...
it's innocent in that way.
It's very relatable.
Yes.
And it's very grounded for the most part. It kind of keeps things, it sort of slowly builds up to this. There are a few outlandish set pieces. There's some gross out gags. And it's all, the main comedic set piece is him dancing, and the Nadia character makes Jim strip.
That's right. Nadia, played by Shannon Elizabeth.
There's no reason that American Reunion should be fucked from the start, because it's got similarly relatable story beats at its heart. It's about if you've aged, the people who watch the original are probably going to have grown up, and they should really be going through the same things that the characters are. Jobs, wives, you know, what are we doing? And it's this that classic trope of then, oh, go back to your high school reunion and see how you've moved on. But the film, it just starts off, nothing is grounded. Everything, they go straight for the immediately, like, ludicrous version of events. The opening scene, of which I alluded to at the beginning, is it opens with the creaking of a bed, and you're thinking, oh, the joke, they're going to be shagging, and the joke is Alison Hannigan is rocking their toddler to bed. It's in a really brightly lit room, and the toddler is the size of a fucking
a pit bull terrier.
It's massive. This kid, no one. I'm a parent. I'm looking like no one puts a kid to bed like this. And also, this kid's massive. And then she just goes, oh, okay. So the joke is, ah, ha, ha, they're not shagging. They've got kids. Okay, then she gets the kid out of the room. And then she says, oh, can I have a bath? And Jim says, yeah, okay, you have a bath. And
Let me do the next bit. And then Jim looks over and then he looks back, he does a double take, and he goes, bow, 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 bow. I'll do this music under it. You tell what happened. Bow, 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 bow.
Okay, so we're supposed to believe. So Jim's thought, oh, wife's off to a bath. My kid is only just gone to sleep. This is the perfect time to jerk off. Now, anyone who's
loudly,
got a kid,
by the way, with the volume on the computer and all, you know, like no precaution,
no headphones. The lights are fully on. He gets his sock out and he fills it with KY jelly. I hated that joke in the first one. Like the amount of whenever American source comedies feature a man or boy jerking off, there are all these lotions coming out. He's thinking, "What the fuck?" See, this is why I can't connect to it immediately. Also, the time he's picked this time, the worst time. But for the film logic to work, the film is trying to say, "Oh, Jim and Thingy are married now and they don't have sex anymore." Jim starts jerking off in this ludicrous fashion, and then the kid pops up immediately. A dark notion, but the film plays it for laughs. He slams the laptop down. Oh, of course he does it on the end of his dick. And then the boy starts, he's not scarred for life.
He's none the wiser, despite his huge size. Doesn't seem to have noticed what's going on.
And then here's the topper. They go into the bathroom and Mum is frigging herself off with the shower head.
Yeah.
And then film begins. So we have begun at 10.
My okay, the bed is on fire with passionate love. Well, I would say also that the one other problem with the American Pie sequels is that while Jim and Allison's story updates, obviously, in a way that can be applicable to audiences of the time and their age and whatever, the other characters in the gang, as their story updates for every new film, it sort of gets weaker and weaker to the point where the superficiality that was there in the first film is totally exposed by now, because poor old Kevin and Chris, Chris Klein, who plays Oz, Kevin and Oz, they just have exactly the same story in every film. And with Kevin, it's that he was in a relationship with Tara and he misunderstood her, and she overreacts to the misunderstanding, and then he apologizes like a good American and she accepts it and they have
like
a good time.
Like a good American.
Right? Yeah, like a nice American who apologizes, you know what I'm saying?
Tiny little sidebar. I love the fact that you're calling the men by their characters' names and the women by their real names.
I can't remember. What's Tara Reid's character name here?
I don't know.
Vicky, yes.
And, but let's call them by all of them by their actor names.
And then
that's the thing.
Oz,
played by Chris Klein.
His story is that he meets the nice choir girl, played by Mina Savari, Heather, in the first film. And while he's a kind of cool jock guy and she's a sort of choir person, he's the sensitive one in the group and he finds real love with her. And they, you know, he loses his virginity to her in the film also. And then in every subsequent film, there's something about the innocence of their relationship being questioned, but they always come back to being innocent together again. And that's sort of okay for one or two films, but by the time you get to the fourth time round, it's just ridiculous. I mean, Kevin and Tara Reid might as well not be in the film. They aren't part of the story. They are totally unrelated to what's happening in the film. So the film dedicates five scenes, maybe, to their interactions. They're only there because they were in the original. There's no purpose for them driving the story forwards at all. Oz and Heather's a little bit different, maybe, because Oz's character has been updated and he's famous. He's a sports media personality now, and he's been on a famous reality TV dancing show in America. So all of the women in his hometown know who he is and all find him really sexy. There's a bit more updated there. But the central storyline is just exactly the same. And it's so superficial and stupid. And crucially, like, it's not funny, you know? I don't mind if it's pointless, but it's showered with amusing gags and, you know, silly scenes. But it's just like, I don't know, it's like, you know, you've got a great old friend from school that you really want to see again. That's Jim. But in order to see him, you also have to go and see all these other people that you would never have seen again otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, the fun of the first one, such as it is you recognise these teenage boys who will go to any lengths to, you know, go out with a girl, and they'll embarrass themselves and they'll make a cunt of themselves.
And they'll do it in different ways that suits their different characters.
Yeah, and therein lies the supposed laughter. 20 years on, over 10 years later, they're all grown-ups, and none of them are good enough actors to play grown-ups. They all look exactly the same age. So what is this film about? It's not about friendship.
You say that, but actually I just watched in the background some scenes from the first American Pie, and Jason Biggs looks so young in it versus what we just watched.
But like, this film could be about friendship and about how they've moved apart and they miss each other. And there is this, like, there are these little notions that could be interesting. His friends want him to stay out and party, but his wife feels like, oh, they need to have sex and reconnect because they haven't since they've had a kid. Now that's in my wheelhouse. That should be speaking to me. I've been there. Like, they could reconnect. He could reconnect with his wife at any time, and his wife, Alison Hannigan, is insisting they do it over this one weekend where he sees his friends he hasn't seen in a million years. It's like, come on, Alison, give me a break. I haven't seen my friends. Don't introduce phony stakes into this fucking movie. I haven't seen these guys in ages. Let's have the reunion, and then we can reconnect spiritually and bodily
on Monday
next week. Monday.
And to be fair, Alison Hannigan would probably say, Adam, I get it. I don't like these phony stakes either. I've been told to say these lines by the people that wrote this film.
Yeah, and I'm the nagging harridan.
Yeah.
And then Jason Biggs' character, Jim, meanwhile, never mind he's busy trying to meet his friends and his wife wants to reconnect, he's got a 18-year-old neighbour who he used to babysit,
sure,
who just wants to fuck him for the whole movie.
Yeah.
His B-plot, and it is deeply, deeply uncomfortable to watch. It's horrible.
It is bad.
And the film plays it for laughs.
I have to say, I didn't see that many of the scenes, including that actor, because I had to keep skipping through them to save my embarrassment.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. I laughed when he said, he talks about the one, Stifler talks about the one that got away, and he refers to this girl at high school as the creme de my cock.
Yeah.
Which
I think her name is Lonnie Lipstein.
But then, of course, that plot line ends in a really deeply, deeply dreary fashion. She's grown up. She used to be really attractive, and then we see her, and she's a bit larger.
Sure.
And then, therefore, disgusting to Stifler, and he's appalled. And he drags her into a bathroom, and he's like, "Oh, come on, then." You know, he doesn't say "suck my dick," but
what happens in this scene? Because I skipped it.
Oh, right. So she
there was
says,
"There's a whole 10-minute chunk at that party that I couldn't watch because every scene had something not good in it."
So Stifler drags the lips girl into a bathroom, and is kind of horrible. But she's a sister doing it for herself, and she says, no, you have to do me first. And this is pitched as this most disgusting of acts. He has to go down on a woman before he gets a blowjob. So the hilarity is he goes down on a larger lady, and he brings her to climax. After the film is cut away to the other horrible shit bits of comedy, and he cuts to his face, and his face is covered and smeared with you know, stuff.
Sure,
it's horrible and it's not funny. And then he's like, right, my turn. And then the girl goes, ha ha ha, no, now you know what it feels like, and that's it. Now the film is suggesting that the idea of going down on a woman is a punishment. Like, as if a man couldn't enjoy that, and that would be an exciting prelude to, like, connecting with a woman.
Yeah.
It's just this... It's so retrograde. I just was tearing my face off.
Yeah.
And you missed it all. You got to skip bits.
I skipped that, for sure.
But I really enjoyed watching Meet the Parents. I hadn't seen that for probably 20 years, and that really stands up. That does exactly the thing. It grounds the comedy. It dials things up so slowly. Ben Stiller's character, he makes these tiny little mistakes. He makes these minor decisions where, to cover some embarrassment, he'll say a thing, and then the next scene, it comes back to bite him on the arse. So come the end, when he is on the roof trying to chase a cat down, you're with him. The film has taken you along on that journey. So when he does something really, really stupid, you totally buy it. And it's fucking funny. This, you know, apart from creme de my coq, I'm not laughing.
It's funny that you mention Meet the Parents, because we were talking earlier about comedy sequels and how often they don't work. I think Meet the Fockers is very funny, but largely... excuse me. But largely on based on the performances of
Hoffman and Streisand.
Yeah, Barbara Streisand, Dustin Hoffman, who I think are great as Greg's mum and dad. The film itself isn't great, but their performances are great. And I think American Pie 2 stands up it doesn't stand up now, but versus the first film, it stands up as a fairly strong film. On the whole, though, it is hard to find sequels to popular comedy films that are really in any way good. I mean, the obvious one that comes to mind, which isn't good, is Anchorman 2. And I think in some ways, the funnier the first film, the harder it is to nail the sequel.
I mean, there's no reason... Like, Anchorman 2, I just can't... I can't understand how that was so bad. Like, because it's the same talented guys... Like, they could just... They basically just have to riff and be funny. I think they probably left it too late. And I think originally they wanted it to be a musical. People forget. I mean, maybe they never even knew. The first film was not a big film. It didn't do well. But it slowly did well, and people watched, and then it kind of entered the culture.
Yeah.
I think so. By the time they did the sequel, I think they were all a bit... I think maybe they'd forgotten what had made it so good.
Right.
So, but that I can't... I just can't even fathom why that doesn't work.
Well, I have a couple of suggestions for ones that I think did, or at least there's one I found a great Reddit thread when I was looking for... Looking for sequels to comedy films. The one that popped out to me...
Before you read out your list, I would say the reason why comedy films would struggle, the sequels struggle, is because at the end of a comedy, at the end of a film, characters are supposed to have learned something, and so they've changed. And so then when you meet them in the sequel, the sequel always tries to fudge it and return them back to their pre-state version, even though they have renewed themselves, which is why sitcoms are so good, because sitcoms always, they characters never learn anything. So you can't, I think that's why, that's probably partly why a comedy sequel as a film can't really work without heavily fudging it. And it's always just like, it can't recapture the magic. But go on, then hit me the ones that work.
Well, in that case, I think that it's interesting that you say that, because the couple of examples here in this Reddit thread, one of which I haven't seen, but it's mentioned several times, so I will mention it. Both of these examples are fairly surreal comedies, and I think that might set expectations that the characters don't learn anything in the way that you might expect them to through American Pie, for example. So the one I haven't seen is Wayne's World 2, but there are a lot of people here saying that it is a good film.
You could watch Wayne's World 1 or 2, and they would both be, you know, it's got new jokes, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's like you're watching the second episode of a sitcom.
Well, and here's
Wayne,
like,
doesn't change.
Right, and so the second example I have here is one where I think that is the case. I actually prefer the second film. It's Ace Ventura 2, When Nature Calls, as opposed to Ace Ventura 1, Pet Detective.
Now, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, mm-hmm. has got some horribly dated stuff in.
Yeah.
But that's the film that I... That's how I got into Jim Carrey.
Yes.
So I never saw When Nature Calls.
Oh, really?
Until a lot later.
Oh, okay.
Because it looked like, it looked shit, and it looked like really kind of, yeah, look, I mean, it's just really, it's a bit much, is Ace Ventura. When it's got some amazing jokes in
sure.
it, though.
I mean, listen, just for the scene of him crawling out the back of the rhino, I mean, that's so funny, man. That's so funny
it
to
is.
Me.
I think, do you know what? I'm going to give When Nature Calls, it's got funnier, those key set piece bits.
Yes.
But I think the first one is more successful as a movie you could watch from start to finish.
Yeah.
Although you would start to have problems towards the finale with its treatment of the Sean Young, I was going to call her Sean Penn, the Sean Young character.
Well, okay, so there were other suggestions, but instead I found a fantastic article on our favourite website, screenrant.com, which lists the top 10, what is the title here? The 10 Best Comedy Movie Sequels Ranked. Now, there's a couple in here that I agree with that should be in here, but most of them you definitely won't. In at number 10, Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay. A lot of mentions for that on the Reddit thread as well. People really like that one.
Yeah, I've seen that on the threads. I only ever saw the first Harold and Kumar.
Same. I haven't seen this one either.
And of course, it's not called Go to White Castle in this country, because we don't know what White Castle is.
Yeah.
We know it as Harold and Kumar Get the Munchies.
Get the Munchies, yeah.
But I don't remember anything good, apart from those two guys, that John Cho and what's the other guy?
The other guy.
Or Cal Penn.
Yeah.
Cal Penn, and they're both great together. They've got a lovely, but they're not, it's not funny.
You don't remember him riding the cheetah? That was funny.
Yeah, but there are not, yeah, I mean, there aren't, it didn't stay with me, and so the idea of,
yeah.
But maybe I'll give Guantanamo Bay a go.
Let me know if you do. We can watch it at the same time in separate places. Here's another one that was mentioned on the Reddit thread a lot, is 22 Jump Street in at number 9. Yeah, we've talked about that before. We know you don't like those.
I certainly, do you like 22 Jump Street?
I don't really recall 22 Jump Street. I remember thinking 21 Jump Street was funny. I enjoyed that film, but I can't really... I know I've seen it, I just can't recall anything about it, so don't know. Don't know, really. But I can recall a lot about the next one on the list. In at number 8 is Shrek 2, which is actually a really, really good film, and it 100% deserves to be on this list, and we'll move swiftly on to in at number 7, the Lego Batman movie. Haven't seen it. We've also got Austin Powers in Goldmember.
I was rattling through,
but if you really feel strongly, please
I could just think sometimes I know, I could,
What I didn't want to do is create the impression that we should talk about all of these films in depth, because I think it's not worthwhile.
And people hate it when we do lists.
Well, no, what you're doing is stopping it from being a list. What I'm doing is forcing it into a list. So you're really on the right side of history here. But what were you going to say about the Lego Batman movie?
Do you want to talk about how you're feeling right now?
I don't talk about feelings, Alfred. I don't have any. I've never seen one. I'm a night-stalking, crime-fighting vigilante and a heavy metal rapping machine. I don't feel anything emotionally except for rage. 24/7, 365, at 1,000,000%. And if you think that there's something behind that, then you're crazy. Good night, Alfred.
Sir, it's morning.
I tried watching it and I just found it overwhelmingly like jokes punching me in the face.
Right.
And he worked, Batman, he worked as a little side gag in the first one. But I just, I mean, also the pace of the first one, it was all just... It's all just a bit much.
The kids these days like it fast, don't they? They like everything to be fast, yeah?
And so then you skipped over that to then what was after
that?
Well,
something much slower in Austin Powers Goldmember.
You're insane, Goldmember! And that's the way, I like it.
See, why? Because obviously The Spy Who Shagged Me is better than Goldmember.
Yeah.
So why the fuck are they putting Goldmember in there?
I don't
Goldmember
know.
Goldmember is... real, real dross. There's a couple of, obviously, there's always a couple of great bits.
Yeah.
In all of them.
It also introduces the character of Goldmember, a fourth distinctive character for Myers to portray, whose peculiar behaviour and habit of eating pieces of his own peeling skin are hilarious and feel right in line with the series' offbeat and audacious humour.
You know what? Audacious. I didn't enjoy... that bit of comedic thinking.
I don't like
it either. I thought that was a bit too much.
Yeah, too much. Don't eat your own skin. Yeah. Anchorman 2, the legend continues in at number 5.
Jesus Christ.
That's when you know this is a list of nonsense.
They're just listing
the ones they
films
can remember.
That happen to be sequels, yeah.
Muppets Most Wanted. It's the 8th feature-length Muppets film, and it's a sequel to 2011's The Muppets Most Wanted. Oh, wait. No, I've read that wrong. But you know what I'm saying.
It's the sequel to what Jason Segel did a reboot.
Sure.
The Muppets, and then they did Most Wanted.
Right.
That got absolutely panned. Ricky Gervais is in that.
Really? Well, Screen Rant are rewriting history here. In at 3, I agree. Meet the Fockers. We all like that film. Then there's Scream 2.
I had to stop watching that.
Yeah.
The reason why...
Scream 2 came in at number 2.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fucking A,
Scream
finally.
2, much like its predecessor, successfully combines thrills and humour.
I mean, I would say this is Scream 2 is not a comedy. Scream 1 is not a fucking comedy.
Right.
So the idea that they think they can pad out their list with Scream 2, yes, it's a really great film.
Well...
Actually, no, really great. It's a really good film.
Screen Rants say it continues and broadens the first clever self-aware humour by deconstructing the conventions of horror sequels.
That's not a comedy. It's not a comedy.
Well...
We had this whole argument about genre.
Yeah.
Whatever your first genre is, that's what you are.
I think that was Screen Rant as well. Well, anyway, in at number 1...
Oh, wait. Come on, drum roll. Build the suspense. Come on, man.
It's Deadpool 2. Do you want to play the box office game?
Yeah, I feel like quite like heightened aggro state, and I want to like be, you know, get to like a nicer, more positive place.
I'd love
so
that
please.
For you as well. I'd love that for you. I think in order to achieve that, we should play a game that historically takes you to an even more aggro place. Now, first, please guess for me the brackets estimated budget for American Pie Reunion. What do you think a movie like this costs? Actually, let me rephrase that question. Not what do you think a movie like this costs, but what do you think a movie like this that also is a reunion of a big popular franchise costs?
Well, it's comedy. It's cheap.
Uh-huh.
These films are supposed to be cheap.
Sure.
It looks cheap.
Yep.
All they've had to do, all they're spending it on is these douchebags who star in it.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, all of these fuckers are nothing.
Where do you think they are, by the way? Because I, I, I really like wherever that is in America. Like, I want to live near the lake and, you know, in those nice houses and in the idyllic American town. Like, but I don't know what state they're supposed to be in or where they filmed it.
I know. Yeah, it's America.
Let me look.
Where did they film
American Pie?
No, but where's it supposed to be set?
That's shot in Southern California in Long Beach.
But where's it supposed to be?
Where is American Pie set?
It'll be based, like, the guys who came up with the original, the Whites brothers.
Michigan. East Great Falls High School in Michigan. But there's no way Michigan looks like that, right? Isn't Michigan too cold?
Well, not always, not in the summer.
I guess not, yeah. And they do always make the films in the summer.
So let's say it costs $50 million.
Yeah, that's exactly what it cost.
Are you joking?
No, that's quite literally exactly what it is estimated to have cost. On IMDb.
Did I bullseye it?
You did bullseye it. Yeah, you full on bullseye it. I really wasn't expecting that because when you were setting it up saying it's going to be cheap, it looks like shit, everyone's free. Yeah, I thought this guy's going to say something like 25 million and I'll rake him over the coals. But no, you popped it right in the middle of the bazinga and, you know, you slapped it on the ass as hard as Stifler slaps every woman on the ass in this film.
Yeah, that guest was a young woman's bottom.
Yeah.
Sorry, the budget was a young woman's bottom.
Yeah.
And my guess was Stifler's disgusting hand.
That's correct. Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Now, if that was that, then the opening weekend US and Canada is, of course, the Finch's mum of the... this doesn't work, this bit.
It doesn't matter. Keep
going.
What
do you think? What do you think? The opening weekend US and Canada, April 8th,
it's Finch.
2012, Finch's mum...
You already slipped.
They dropped 50 mil.
You already spilt the beans.
How's that?
The original pie. No, you spilt the original beans on pie. Maybe you didn't mean in the first film. So the hunger for the franchise, it sets the bar. So I know where the bar is.
Where's the bar?
The bar's at 18 million.
Well, and does this exceed the bar or does this... flop under the bar like a pole vaulter at the Olympics.
I can't imagine that it could possibly exceed that. The buzz around, everyone really wants, they're champing at the bit for more of this smut in 2012.
I watched this in the cinema.
Yeah, so did I.
Right.
That's the only time I watched it.
Sure.
20 million.
It did 21.5.
Oh, yes, please.
It definitely did exceed the bar. That was placed, but of course, with inflation and over 10 years, it didn't at all.
And with more money spent on their paychecks,
vastly more money. Now, gross worldwide for American Pie Reunion. How do you go about approaching this one?
Well, you said like you do it like times it by 10.
Sure, yeah. It's a handy indicator, that one.
You should never have said that.
I would, to be honest, I'm surprised you hadn't worked that out over the past 50 episodes. But
I don't look back.
Well, what do you think the gross worldwide is then?
What? That means it's not making 200 million, is it? Is it making 200 million?
Well, look, the opening weekend US and Canada, I'll remind you, was 21,500,000.
Yeah, so 200 million.
Well, I mean, that would be under 10 times.
Yeah, it's a rough guide.
Sure, sure.
I don't want it to earn any more than 200. So if it has, I'll take the loss.
So you're saying 200?
I'm saying 200 million point five.
200 million point five. And we're going with we're applying the 10% rule here.
You can do whatever rule you like.
Listen. All I'll tell you is the maths that I've worked out over the weeks that we've been recording this has been that if you take the 10% rule, and you take the 10x rule and you combine them together, then you tend to win. Whereas what you're doing is you're taking off 15 million before you make your guess. And the 10% involved here, given that it's going to be over 200, would be 20. So you might be missing out, you know. That's all I'm saying.
So you're saying, but that rule, so...
I'm not adding them. I'm saying you get the 10% leeway either way of what you say, right?
I know.
So if you said exactly 10 times the opening weekend of US and Canada, that would have been $215 million, right?
Right.
That's what that would have been. 10% of that is 21.50, and you would have just been inside if you'd done that, because the gross worldwide is actually $235 million. That's how much it made.
Right.
But because you reduced by 15 million unnecessarily, ignoring the 10 times rule, then the 10% leeway, you no longer have enough leeway, so you actually lose the game, because even though you described the rules, you then didn't. Don't round down. That's not part of the thing. If you round down, you lose. That's the. So remember this for next week.
But I'm not trying to win. Again. No, I'm not trying to win. I'm trying to say numbers that feel true.
I think the times we live in are very stressful. And people want to laugh. You know, they want to enjoy themselves, you know, forget their worries. And things are a little silly.
I've seen many films since last we recorded, Adam.
You seem particularly proud. I don't, you know, I want to hear what films you've seen, but I just a caveat, I have also seen films.
I'm sure
I
you hear have. About. The expectation is that you watch films all the time. I go through phases of film watching. I go through phases of like binging a lot of films in a big go.
Oh, okay.
And then I don't watch a film for a month. You know, it's a strange, I oscillate between TV and films.
Just a brief again.
So Jean,
a colleague of mine at work, a young colleague, said to me that she'd watched Midsommar on TikTok.
The whole film?
The whole film.
On
people
TikTok.
On TikTok. They upload these people, pirates.
Pirates.
In my day, we called these fuckers pirates.
Yeah, yeah.
Piracy is theft.
Yep.
You know,
you wouldn't go into a movie studio and be there for a month watching the creation of a film for free, would you? Unless you were a best boy.
You wouldn't steal a car. You wouldn't steal some food.
Yeah.
Oh, you'd steal a movie, would you?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I grew up with, and I believe that.
That's right.
And
I had a funny thing not long ago. It happened to me. Who was it with? It was with someone. Oh, I recall. It was a sort of, how do I describe this? I actually don't mind if this person ever heard this, because I feel a little bad about it, but it was a family member's partner. So someone I know through the family connection. That's the sort of primary reason for bringing us together. He's a very nice man, and I enjoy spending time with him. And we have things in common and interests in common. But we were talking about, it wasn't a film, it was a piece of software. We were talking about a piece of software, and because he uses this piece of software, it's a recording software. Piece of recording software, and I was asking him about it because I was getting a new computer, and I thought I might make a bit more music. And actually, it's what I've been using to make jingles for this podcast, so it's going well, you know. And the piece of software, it costs about £200. It's a one-off fee, which I much prefer to paying an ongoing subscription for something like that. And
Adobe, looking at you.
Yeah, exactly. And he very kindly said to me while he was around my house for dinner, he told me all about it and said, oh, you'll really like it. I can give you some tips if you want. And I have a cracked version, actually, I can get you one if you want it. And I sort of said, you know, my wife was there, his partner was there, and we were all in the conversation. I sort of said, like, oh, no thanks. You know, I like to pay for stuff. That's what I said. What I meant was like, and then I said, like, I think I've got past the point in my life where I don't pirate movies anymore, or, you know, download albums or whatever. Like, you know, I just pay for stuff now. And he's older than me. And so the more I spoke, the more it was just, I was just digging a hole and saying, essentially, he would have heard me saying, you're scum. You shouldn't have this, shouldn't be offering it around. I'm better than you. I can afford it.
Ooh, you are.
You know, and I want to pay for it because I'm a good citizen and you're not. Yep. And I that's not what I meant. What I was actually embarrassed about the fact that I was like, oh no, I don't want to. It's like someone offers you, hey, do you want a toke on this doobie? And I'm saying like, oh, sorry, no, I'm not a, I don't take drugs, you know, that sort of thing.
I think that's how he took it, surely that way.
I think probably, but like in my, I just kept digging a more and more of a hole and I couldn't leave it alone. Like I just made it so much worse.
You do make things worse. I have observed that.
I'm the worst maker for sure.
So Joe, tell me what films you've been watching.
Well, I've seen six films. Some of them I won't linger on too long. A good mixture of films I didn't enjoy.
I'll be the judge of where you linger.
Well, okay, fine. Well,
you might linger.
There's a good mix of ones that I did and didn't enjoy here. And the first I very much didn't enjoy. I watched the film Battle of the Sexes. Do you remember that one?
Never saw it.
No. Well,
I love Emma Stone.
Steve Carell and Emma Stone and other people. And the Andrea Riseborough is in it as well.
Is she?
She is. Yeah, she's I don't think it's her fault, but the character is appalling. It's an appalling character.
I don't think it's her fault. She signed up to be in it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that she's in it is definitely her fault. But who wouldn't want to be? I mean, come on, Emma Stone, you know, you're playing Emma Stone's love interest. I think you would want to be in that if you're Andrea Riseborough. But no, that character's appalling. Right. No, just from a status perspective and also playing opposite, you know, fabulous Oscar-winning actor. I don't mean because she wants to get groovy with Stone. I simply mean because that's a great career move.
The caveat, you needed that because I needed thought you that.
Okay, right, yeah.
Yeah, because I thought, yeah, I mean, if I'd want to play that role too.
You thought I was getting steamy because of the nature of today's podcast episode.
Sorry.
No, more that it's a great career move for a good actor, you know, for a British actor as well.
She's great.
She is
But the
great.
Role, what? So what's unappealing about what, well, the character itself or...
The thing is
it just this, badly written? Or
you haven't seen the film, right? So, but you recall the way the trailer sort of sold the film?
No, I don't even. They sold it as the Battle of the Sexes. Oh, women can play tennis too. Steve Carell, is like, women can't play tennis. I'm an old pro.
Yeah, a retired pro. He's like nearly 50.
And she's going to stick it on him.
That's right. And it's kind of it's at the outset.
Sisters are doing it for themselves.
And they quite literally are. So, you know, this story, you know, is of a real thing that happened. The trailer very much sells it as all about the match between these two people. And those moments are fun because they're two great actors and that's interesting. And, you know, whereas actually what happens in the film is that Steve Carell has a sort of a bit of a sob story. There's a reason he's doing it. He doesn't really believe the things that he's saying. The film isn't really at all about whether she can beat him or not. That, you know, in terms of like the personal journey of both characters, it's about the growth and the evolution of women's tennis. But it's mainly about getting women's tennis on the map. But it's also about homophobia in America, because the character that Emma Stone plays is married to a man. She's a, you know, the best tennis player in America, or perhaps in the world. But she also is attracted to women. And Andrea Riseborough plays a hairdresser who cuts her hair, and they exchange these glances. And then she, you know, Andrea Riseborough comes to watch her play tennis and kind of ends up on this tour as her hairdresser. I don't know. Andrea Riseborough's character is written to be like this weird, dreamy, sort of, you know, forlorn, a little bit lost, a little bit very kind of stereotypical California woman who Emma Stone is completely entranced by. And so Andrea Riseborough has to play someone that Emma Stone would be entranced by. And it's just so... It's not over the top in terms of the acting performance. The dynamic of these characters is just, it's just so cloying, you know? I think the character work generally is poor. It's very confused. And I don't know. It's basically I thought it was quite a poorly made film, or at least a film that, you know, didn't make a lot of sense. It was very boring. It didn't really start until halfway through, and that's because there isn't really a film. Like, there's a really good, interesting thing that happened, and there's an important point in the history of women's tennis That's what there is. I don't think everything has a film made out of it. And I think the stuff that they had to use as padding around this, whilst all of these things individually are very worthy of, you know, of cinema, when they were all put together, it was just sort of confusing to the extent where Emma Stone's character was completely different in one scene to the next. There's no consistency of who she is. And as a result, I thought it was a bad film.
Yeah.
I would say it's not one to watch for anyone who hadn't seen it and when it pops up on a streaming site. And I would say it's probably one that everyone involved will look back on and go, that didn't quite work the way that we wanted it to, you know.
I think it's a good warning because it's one of those films, it's got the thumbnail. I know it's got Carell, Stone, you'd go, oh. And you might think, oh man, I've watched every other shit thing on this thing. Okay, maybe this will do for Sunday evening.
And they're both incredible actors. It's got the sell. It's not worth it. Don't watch it.
Great. Well, I wasn't going to.
Good.
I don't need it. I mean, I'm just saying that's for everyone else.
Okay. Well, the next one on the list, you'll have seen this. I was in Edinburgh with my wife, and we were in our little apartment one night, and we thought, we'll stick a movie on. We've been out. It's busy out there. It's hot. What should we watch? Flicking through stuff for ages as it is, you know. Eventually we come to a compromise that I wasn't particularly happy with, but I was happier with than continuing to look, and that was Notting Hill, which I hadn't seen for a long time.
I'm not happy. I mean, that feels like, doesn't feel like a compromise. That feels like you just waving a white flag and saying, oh yeah, come on in.
That's kind of what happened. But here's what I thought about Notting Hill. I thought the sexual politics leave rather a lot to be desired. I think that's the first thing to say. Most of the jokes aren't funny. And also the patter isn't very good either. Plus, you know, patter is, I would say, that's one step below jokes. When there's no jokes, there might be patter. And it's okay if you have a film where patter's funny. But if the patter's not funny and there's no jokes, that's no good.
That film's pure patter. Four weddings. It's all patter.
It's all patter. And it's batter patter. It's batter patter.
The scene I remember is when he first invites, Hugh Grant invites Anna Scott, aka Julia Roberts, to the dinner.
Yes.
Round to his sister.
To his friend's house for his sister's birthday.
Sister's birthday. And you've got all the characters.
Yep.
And you've got, you know, and then they're all, the whole thing is like, who can get the last brownie? Who's got the saddest story?
Yeah.
And it's this excruciating sequence whereby it's as cloying as a brownie. People getting to introduce pathos, sad, and then like putting joke, like, oh, I'm going to introduce character depth here, but then I'm going to put a little joke on. I'm going to pretend that I'm not cloying. Ugh, I'm puking everywhere. It's just rubbish.
It's very sincere. It is very sincere, that scene. And also, I have to say, the Julia Roberts character is basically awful. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why Hugh Grant should want her back, except that she's, you know, sexy and a movie star and whatever.
That's a big reason, my friend.
Sure, but it doesn't work on the kind of basic level of love. Having said that... I really enjoyed it, and I couldn't work out afterwards whether that was just because like it was nostalgia for a time that never existed, or if the film like somehow has a charm of its own that's like independent of the two leads, you know, because it's
Joe.
It really only works if you find Hugh Grant charming, and he's not anymore in this film. But there's just something about it that I really liked.
Yeah, this is so perfect. I've been thinking about this exact thing, and I don't use this term, but the term that people use, and I want to come up with a new one. I think they call certain films critic-proof movies.
Right. Yeah.
And this is exactly what I've been thinking about because Forrest Gump is 30 years old.
Right.
And there've been all these articles, retrospectives about Forrest Gump. I saw that in the cinema, so I'm now old enough to be old enough for a film that I saw at the cinema to be talked about as if it's this kind of classic.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I find very strange.
Yeah.
But that film, Forrest Gump, is it's not a good film, but it is entertaining and you it just goes down real smooth. It's a kind of irrelevant what anyone would say about it. If someone said they loved Forrest Gump, I'd think maybe you need to see more movies, or that's their favourite film. I'd say, yeah, see more movies, but I'm not gonna go get in on them like I'm 15 again. And I think it's the same with Notting Hill. There is something about films of that scale, like likability, and I don't like the phrase guilty pleasure. People like what they like. You know, these films they're canon, classic. Just they bang them on, and they're crowd pleasers, and people like them. And like, I don't think you have to like dig deeper than that, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, you meet people like this that on the surface you can't identify anything about them that you would sort of rationally say, "Oh, I like that." But you really enjoy spending time with them, you know. Like it's a phenomenon.
Are you talking about me? You fucking talking about me?
No, I'm teasing you. Yeah,
it's good. No, it's good. That was good. That I really. That was very lovely. I thought you might. I thought we could continue that for a little bit.
Well, here's another film that I saw when I was in Edinburgh.
Did Megan like Notting Hill?
Yeah, we both really enjoyed it. I think also we were together. We were mocking it a bit together. We were laughing about it. We were sort of saying, you know, it's funny that anyone ever, you know, found this super charming. There's also something personal for me about it, because my father did not look like Hugh Grant, okay? But he dressed like Hugh Grant dresses in Notting Hill. It's very weird. Like
I've seen the photos.
Right.
Yeah, he does.
He always wore like black jeans, and he always wore a shirt. Well, not always, but like he often wore a shirt for a man that worked in a pub. This was, you know, funny that I think he had some kind of weird sensibility thing. And you'd see him at the end of the bar, and he'd be wearing his sort of like light blue shirt with his sleeves rolled up, working in the pub with his jeans on, and he'd have the Guardian rolled up under his arm. And he cast a very Hugh Grant-like aesthetic, you know, minus the hair and the warbling and the horse and hound. So whenever I watch...
And the shagging of Julia Roberts.
But whenever I watch Notting Hill, I also think of my dad, despite the fact that, you know, there's not really, apart from him being a kind of man walking around London with, you know, here's another thing, right? It's people that walk around central London without a bag because they live nearby. It's a very specific thing, right? But everyone's got a bag, right? Everyone's commuting. We've all got bags. We're carrying shit. We're going in and out of London. But when you walk around Angel, or you walk around Westminster, or you walk around, you know, even let's say like as far down as Bank, for example, and you see someone with a shirt and jeans on, with the shirt sleeves rolled up, and they haven't got a bag, it's because they live nearby or they're coming out of the office. Do you get what I'm saying? There's a thing.
Apologies to our foreign listeners who have no idea about what Joe's talking
about.
Just,
there's something
very specific
about
and our northern listeners,
the sort of the metropolitan man, you know.
yeah. No, I know what you. I think thing is, I'm going to say I know what you're talking about, but I also
walking
don't
a dog,
know what the fuck
walking
you're
a dog in a city
about.
Center. There's, I know, yeah, I'm not communicating it very well. But
men who don't have bags, it's because they live nearby, because they own a fucking mansion next to Buckingham Palace. You've seen them. We know what you
They're
look
around.
Like.
Yeah, they haven't got bags or coats or, you know, but they've got a dog. They've got a dog and there's just something like a... It's the way that Hugh Grant walks from his Notting Hill home to his Notting Hill book travel store and, you know...
Without a bag.
There's the great scene in Notting Hill where he, you know, it's after one of the breakups. The great scene in Notting Hill. You've
without
heard about
the
that
bag
one.
Scene.
Without the bag. The scene where he's walking without the bag. He has his coat... and he's it's the scene where he, as he's walking, it's a montage. The seasons change.
Oh, he's bagless.
You remember? But he hasn't got a bag. Yeah. And this is all year round he hasn't got a bag. It's not just in the summer or in the winter. It's year round he doesn't have a bag. This is a man without a bag in central London. So I mean it's in Notting Hill, it's not in central London. But you understand what I'm saying now.
No, now I do.
Yeah, now
yeah,
you
he's
do.
He's mad. He's without a bag.
Without a bag. But anyway, when I was in Edinburgh, I also went to the cinema on a day we were waiting for a very late train, and we checked out, so we were sort of, okay, what can we do? Let's go to the cinema.
So, yeah, what did you see?
Well, I went to see the film called Thelma in the cinema.
Oh, right.
There wasn't much on.
Yeah, that really plopped out.
It was a choice between Thelma and the Hurricane one.
Twisters. Why didn't you see that?
I don't know, because I thought it was about Twisters, and I thought, well, I don't care about Twisters. But anyway, we loved Thelma. Thelma, of course, a 93-year-old woman falls for a phone scam and then basically spends the rest of the film going on an adventure across the city that she lives in order to get her money back from the phone scam. And Thelma is played by June Squibb, who was actually also 93 when she filmed Thelma, which is great. She's hilarious. She's very funny. The script has her several times go up to other elderly people in the street that she thinks she might know. And this is the best bit about the film, I think. It's a repeat gag, and I won't spoil it, but it does actually pay off later in the film. But she'll go up to someone elderly and she'll go, I think I recognise you. And they sort of cut to 5 minutes later when they've both realised that they don't know each other. They just look familiar, and then they say thanks and move on. This happens a few times. It's a great observation. It's very sweet and funny. And then it pays off because it relates to the plot of the film. And when that happened, I just thought, yes, this is a good film. This is a good film. It's not just the funniest bit. It's also relevant to the story. It's very sweet. And I don't think it's, you know, but it's far from like an excellent movie. It's not one that I would encourage people to rush out and go and watch. But if you find yourself, you know, bored and on a Sunday afternoon or something, and you want something quite light and also something that does well to deal with the pretty heavy themes of aging, you know, there are essentially like two alternate perspectives that the film shares. One of them is Thelma's perspective, which is that she might be 93 and her family might think she needs help, but she values her independence and she doesn't want that. And she's going on this adventure to prove that she's still independent. That's true, right? But also her elderly friend who goes on the adventure with her, who says that he lives in the elderly person's home because at some point he realized that he didn't want his family to worry and the right thing to do, and he took the responsibility was to go and do that. So it's very delicate and sweet and thoughtful about that part of life, that part of the aging process, and the difficult things that people of that age have to contend with, suddenly being babied and wearing nappies and all of that kind of stuff, but still trying to maintain some kind of independence. Like I said, it's far from a classic, but I thought what it did, what it set out to do, it did really well. June Squibb is great. And I wouldn't have seen it if I wasn't like hanging around waiting for a train, but I'm really glad that I did.
It's because she, everyone was chatting about her, it was 10 years ago, 11 years ago, when she was in Nebraska. Do you remember Nebraska, that black and white flick?
Yeah,
Bruce Dern and Will Forte. She was an actress and she'd been in stuff, but hadn't, you know, she was old, and then she pops up again in that, and then everyone's talking about June Squibb again. After Nebraska, you know, they're all chatting about her, not in anything. That's it. Everyone forgets about you.
Yeah.
Again. And then she's got to wait 10 years, 11 years.
Until she's 93 years old.
For another pop at the cherry.
Yeah. Well, she takes the whole fucking cherry, man. The cherry is gone. There's no cherry left for anyone else to come. But I really liked it. I thought it was good. Okay, I'll go through a bit more quickly for a couple of these. I watched The Royal Oak, which is that Ken Loach movie.
Yep.
Yeah. It's not charity, it's solidarity. Yeah, pretty good. It pulls its punches a bit more than I, Daniel Blake, which is nice because that was very sad.
Please pull your punches.
And it's a good reminder that people are hungry, you know?
Mm.
Yeah. Far From the Madding Crowd, I watched.
Which version?
The 2014 one with Carey Mulligan in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which, it, you know, it was fun. I enjoyed it. There's some weird casting. I do think, what's his name? Tom Sturridge, who plays the sort of evil baddie. Kind of baddie, not evil, but, you know, the man that she marries, that Bathsheba marries, the soldier. He's so kind of dislikable from the beginning that it's a little hard to engage right there with the story. And every time I watch Far From the Madding Crowd, I always think
Sergeant Troy, played by Terrence Stamp.
But I always think it's funny that this story is as famous as it is. Like, I did it, I studied it in university, the book, obviously. But I feel like it lacks all the interesting twists of like the Austen novels. It feels like really soap opera-y, but for like the 1800s. I sort of understand why people would have, at the time, why people would have gravitated towards it, because, you know, there weren't that many pieces of literature or fiction around that were showing like quite such an independent woman making choices on her own. You know, I think like I totally get that element of it, but it's always funny to me that it's kind of survived as it has in the canon, because the story is kind of shit.
I guess because it's quite romantic, even though there's a lot of darkness in it. It's literary and romantic, and that's why it's knocked around. Directed by Thomas, that version is directed by Thomas Vinterberg.
Yes.
Of The Hunt fame.
Yes. Great. And Another director. Round. You like those films.
Yeah, and The Celebration.
Right.
I remember, that for me could have been a film you forgot.
Yeah.
I can't remember a thing about.
Oh, you did watch
that
it?
That version. Yeah, I've watched it in cinema with my wife. She loves the book.
Right.
Loved the version with Terrence Stamp in.
Yeah.
Sergeant Troy. Mm-hmm.
I'll have to talk to your wife about it then, because it's a bit perplexing to me.
Yeah, yeah. She'll know. I think you need to know the text and...
Yeah.
And I tried to read it and I got so bored.
Yeah.
I stopped reading it. Yeah. There was like someone was in a fucking... a rickety, what are they called? Like a horse-drawn carriage, like stuck in the hay for ages. I was like, when's this going to kick in?
It's so dark when the sheepdog chases all the sheep off the cliff at the very beginning of the film. Do you remember that?
No, I can't remember a thing about it.
Pretty bad. It's very dark, that bit. But anyway, there you go. I watched that.
I watched on my holiday, because you've mentioned that and you mentioned Jane Austen. This fits. I'm not crowbarring.
No, go.
I watched Pride and Prejudice, directed by Joe Wright.
Is that the Keira Knightley version?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Donald Sutherland version.
The Matt... What's his name from Succession?
Matthew McFadden.
Yeah.
And I kept asking my wife, I said, is he a good Darcy? How does he compare? She went, yeah, he's all right.
He is okay,
I think he's good. I think towards the end, I was so bored slash familiar.
Yeah.
I kind of thought, I think I watched this before in the same place with my wife 2 years ago, and I've forgotten everything about it.
Yeah.
And I've thought that this was a choice, because I wanted to watch like RoboCop or anything.
Of course.
Two nights before I'd rewatched The Prestige. I was absolutely over the moon to spend time with that. The only reason I put it on is because there was such a lack of anything. And then, you know, we had a moment. I popped that. I was like, I'll pop this on for... I know she loves it. Let's watch it. And I was like, I don't think I'd seen it.
Does she love that version, though?
No, I think she likes it. She obviously loves... She loves your version, the telly version.
I mean, that's far, far, far superior.
Yeah, but I'm not watching that.
No.
Anyway, what
you should have watched Sense and Sensibility. If you're looking... You know, that's such a great movie. Or Howard's End is lovely.
This wasn't an option.
No, it wasn't an option. Okay. Well, the final film that I watched was... a film I never really thought I would watch. It could have been a Forgot You Forgot if I'd seen it the first time round. The Mountain Between Us. Are you familiar with this film?
Oh, I know of it. Idris Elba and Kate Winslet.
Idris Elba, Kate Winslet, stranded on a mountain range after a plane crash with a dog. They're strangers. They fall in love trying to get back to civilization, basically. That's what the film is. And it's a very odd movie, Adam.
If you think it's worth watching... Caveat what you're going to say. If you don't, spill the beans.
I really don't know if it's worth watching or not, but I'm not going to say any. I'm not going to give any I'm not going to give any spoilers or anything.
Hani Abu Asad.
Hani Abu Asad, okay.
Oh, he directed Paradise Now.
Right.
Which was pretty good. Okay.
Well, look, it's kind of an odd film. It's, at times, it's like extremely mainstream in a totally straight way. But Kate Winslet is so good that you kind of get tricked into thinking that there's more happening, you know. There's kind of one like central theme through line, and the rest of it's pretty janky. Like the deeper theme is, you know, is I guess really just that these two people, no one else could share their experience because they shared it together. In that way, it's very Frodo and Sam. You know what I'm saying? that's really what I took from it.
Hey, Joe, do you know what? Yeah? Given the amount you've chatted about Frodo and Sam, I know exactly what you fucking mean.
Yeah, there's also a mountain in that one as well, but that's much, much more doom involved. This one, I couldn't really work it out, Adam. There were moments in the film where I thought, this is really weird and bad and really janky. And then there were other moments in the film where I was sort of on the verge of tearing up and thinking, God, but I don't know if it's just Winslet is just so good.
She is.
That maybe she'd make anything good. I really don't know.
She does. I remember seeing her in a film called The Reader.
Yeah. I remember that.
It had quite a lot of Oscar buzz at the time. Not a good film.
No.
But she's phenomenal in it. And I didn't think, oh, God, I've wasted my time watching that. It was frustrating to see. But because she's been so great in it, it's been broadly fine. It was probably worth the time. I would never, ever rewatch it. And it's plopped off. Plopped off the canon.
Yeah. Well, this would be one I would say for, you know, an evening in with your, perhaps with your significant other, you know, or alone. Yeah. Or maybe it's not. I'm not committing to recommending it. What I will do is say, I'd be curious to hear what you thought about it. Or what other people think about it, but I'm not recommending that they watch it in order to tell me. Yeah, I want to know what you think, but I won't tell you to watch it to tell me what you think.
Yeah, I mean it's a hedge, and
it needs trimming.
It needs trimming. Well, I
what about you?
I can't look. You know, I could get into what I've seen, mm-hmm. but we'll do me next episode.
Okay.
I've watched lots of things.
Give us one though. Come on.
I'll throw away a surprising, I didn't think I'd enjoy it type thing. I watched a film called The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
Oh, yes, I've heard of that.
Which is I guess it's a tween movie.
Yep.
From 2006.
Did you watch this with your daughter?
I watched it with my daughter, my 9-year-old daughter, on holiday. Mm-hmm. And then it pops up. I go, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. I know of that. And America Ferrera's in it, and Blake Lively's in it, and the girl from Gilmore Girls is in it. And it's like, oh, it's about four like teenage girls and some pants. I'm like, oh, I could probably watch this. Let's bang it on. And it's super cheesy,
uh-huh.
but it is actually it's sort of quite well done.
Right.
They get there. It's about friendship, and they've been best friends since they were kids. And it's all told, there's loads of voiceover. It's almost like Goodfellas, but yeah, for teenage
right.
girls.
Right.
And they're going to have their first holiday.
Andrea told me she'd meet me down by the locker room. But you got to hand the guy a 20 before you get into the gymnasium.
Yeah, there's loads of stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they're going to have their first summer away from each other. One of them, Gilmore Girls, is going to Greece. And her plot line is basically Mamma Mia before Mamma Mia ever got made.
Right.
One of them has to stay at home in their hometown working at a shitty store. One of them's going to go to soccer camp in like Mexico. That's Blake Lively. And her mum's died. She's got mum grief and she really wants to fuck and lose her virginity. Although the word sex is never mentioned.
Right.
I don't know how they manage it. And America Ferrera is, hers is the most interesting story. She's Her dad, played by Bradley Whitford of West Wing fame, he walked out on her when she and her and her mum when she was nine, and she's got daddy issues, and she's a curvier, larger girl than the others, and they've all got different body shapes, and they've all got different histories. So they're all going to, and she's going to go and see her dad, and they're all, and they find these pants in a thrift store, and the pants fit them all perfectly,
right?
And they imbue the pants with this kind of aura of magic.
But now let me ask you. Sorry, the pants are
trousers,
not English undergarments, underpants.
No, and okay. That was it. That was my daughter's first question. She said, "Sorry," she said, "pants. What? Sorry, pants. What?" And I, Americans call trousers pants.
Right. Yeah.
And she went, she's very baffled by that.
Yeah.
So they create the pants become a totem for them, and they're going to go off on their individual adventures, and they are going to write to each other, and they're going to send each other the pants and pass them on.
Can I pause on the pants thing for a second?
Yeah.
Because also what Americans do, I think I've found, is, you know how you would say, like, if you're talking about jumpers, you'd talk about jumpers in the plural, and you'd say jumpers or sweaters or whatever, yeah? And you'd say the same thing with trousers, right?
Mm.
I'm wearing a jumper, I'm wearing trousers. Americans might say, when they say trousers, they might say, and this is the trouser.
Would they?
When you look at the trouser there, yeah, like some posh English people do it as well. I could never work out if trousers is the plural of a number of different trouser together, or if I'm wearing a jumper and I'm wearing this trouser as well. Can I wear a trouser, or can I only wear trousers?
No, I think you could wear a trouser, but I think you'd have to be a fucking prick to go, I like a trouser. You know, that's a posh knob.
What do you think of my trouser? Because I would never say I'm wearing jumpers. People would be like, no, you're wearing one jumper. What's wrong with you? I'm, yeah, this is my jumpers.
Trousers is the exception.
Yeah.
You're wearing trousers.
Right.
Right?
And I think
do you like a trouser, sir? Shut up.
Right.
It's trousers.
Do you like a trouser, sir?
Do you like a pant?
Yeah.
What pant? But American.
Look at the
pants.
The pant leg. That's what they say.
The pant leg, but you're wearing pants.
Right, yeah.
So the pants is, because there's two of them, it's the confusing thing.
Right.
A pant with two pant next to each other creates pants.
Yeah. Sorry about interrupting.
We're talking language, and that is right in my wheelhouse.
Mm.
So it's really nice, but super super cheesy. The Gilmore Girls plotline is ludicrously her character is she's all kind of shy about her body, and her big moment is stripping down to her bra and underpants and diving into the sea and getting off with a Greek boy.
Right. Her under trouser.
Yeah, her under trousers. But the America Ferrera story of a child feeling abandoned by her father. Now, do you think that spoke to me, or do
well,
you think
I was wondering when you said it was the best one. I'm thinking, was it? Is it the best one, or is it just the one? You know which of these girls you would be if you were in the gang?
It is, but also she is really good in it,
right?
Also they're supposed to be 16, 17, but it feels like they're 30.
It used to feel like that in the past, didn't it?
Maybe they were in their 20s when they acted it.
I think, like, it used to feel like that, and now that the teens feel like teens. I don't know if it's just me that's changed, or if it's the films, but I swear every teenage film and TV series used to be like 30-year-olds playing them. And now it's like, now it is 19 and 18-year-olds.
I think they cast the correct age, but this time they all seem like they're in their early 20s, which also helped me watch it and enjoy it on another level.
Right, right.
But she gets to see her dad, and obviously her dad hasn't told her that he's gonna marry someone else, and he's set up a new family.
Oh my god!
So all that stuff's really
like, and just like your dad.
No, because he created a new family. Right. Bradley Whitford is he's marrying a woman with two grown-up kids,
existing children. Right.
So it's really nicely done, and also like. America Ferrera is, I don't know if she is Puerto Rican. She's playing a Puerto Rican character, and she's got curves, and she's talking about her body. So there's stuff, there's race stuff, and there's body image, and it's quite layered. And then, so that's all really nice. And then the character who stays at home, also, she's the really cynical one, and she wants to be a documentary filmmaker. And you kind of think there's nowhere to go for this character. But she meets this, I think, 12-year-old girl who's like a real smartass. And I tell you what, mate, it's super cheesy, but it really got me. The little 12-year-old girl, she's not too well. It's all I'll say. She's not too well. And it's really, really well done. And when when it came to the end, fuck me. Oh, Jesus.
Wait. Stop. Stop. Turn around. Turn around. Take a step.
Should we play the game where one of us reads out a little list of films to catch out the other one on a movie they forgot?
I think we better do that, Adam. It's your go this week, isn't it?
It's me reading out a list of flicks. And come on, lest we forget, I don't hit you on one of these fives, we will...
Go to the big list. Yeah, the communal list. The communal list. Yeah, that's right. It's there. It's thriving. It's popping. It's hot.
I don't know because I've not looked at it, and I refuse to log into the
email.
Well,
get me then. Get me.
Okay. So here we go. Now You See Me.
Now You See Me. Oh, that's the magic film.
Yeah.
No, I haven't forgotten that, and I hate it.
Mate, the first one is so much...
I hate magic. It's rubbish.
I had such low expectations for that. When I finally watched it, I thought, oh, that's quite fun, that.
No.
It's kind of like an Oceans film. Okay, fine. Okay,
yeah,
okay.
It's like an Oceans film if it sucked and if Oceans was shit and about magic.
Napoleon Dynamite.
No, I don't think that. I think, if anything, that's the inverse of a forgot you forgot. I think it's a remember you remember. You're not that sure why, other than that it sparked a cultural moment. But no, having said that, I will always remember fondly. I think it was Kip trying to convince someone that he could throw a steak. Oh, no, is the uncle? Is it the uncle? Throwing a steak over a mountain, you know? Something about
sounds
throwing
like
a steak over a mountain.
You forgot it, mate.
No.
Hail Caesar.
His head is on fire with passion and pain. The neighbors complain about the noises above. But she only comes when she's on top.
What a lyric.
Ooh.